Unconditional teaching for me very much means accepting that learning belongs to the learner. And for academic writing, I could rephrase a sentence and say writing belongs to the writer. But because the student position is one where students are objects of didactic and sometimes moral and evaluative practices, it's sometimes hard for them to feel that their writing belongs to them. And I think this is one of the most important things that we wanted to do in this book, emphasize that writing belongs to the writers and also to encourage students to think about themselves as writers.
Welcome to the third episode of the Unconditional Teaching podcast. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Katharina Pietsch, Till Zibura, and myself, Jessica Koch. In this episode, I talk to Till and Katharina about their recent book publication, Writing in English Studies, a Guide for Students in English Linguistics and Literature, which they co-authored with Vivian Gramley. We discuss not only the way this book can help students become self-confident authors of academic texts, but also the politics that are part of the process of being and becoming an academic writer.
Till and Katharina, you have worked for the past few months on a book project titled Writing in English Studies, a Guide for Students in English Linguistics and Literature. How did this book project come into being?
So we were approached by the series editor, Svante Lahm, in a book series on academic writing across the disciplines. So she publishes, edits books on academic writing in biology or psychology or other kinds of disciplines. And she asked us to contribute the volume in that series on writing in English studies. And she approached Katharina and I and Vivian Gramley, our colleague, who is a linguist, because in our discipline, English studies in Germany means a combination of the linguistic study of language and of literary and cultural studies. And Vivian Gramley wrote the part in the book on linguistics, and Katharina and I wrote the part on writing in literary and cultural studies.
Let's talk a bit about your part of the project, as I have the two of you here with me to talk about it. Relating to your own biographies as producers, writers, authors of academic texts, what were the key ideas that you wanted to get across in this book?
Well, I think the most important idea or premise that we had for writing this book was that we did not want a normative approach to writing. This is based on the way we think about teaching at university in general and about academic writing or teaching at academic writing in specific, but also based on at least on my writing biography. So, for instance, when I was writing my master's thesis, first I tried to write the way that my supervisor, for instance, but also other people, like, told me, this is the way you have to do it. This is the way one writes these texts. For instance, one piece of advice, or rather of, well, it was more that I felt it was more than advice. It was really like, this is how it's being done. Was, for instance, like, you need to know basically everything you're going to write before you start writing. So you need to have your theory clear. You need to know the analysis, or you need to have done the analysis of your primary text before you start writing. Because otherwise, if you haven't done the stuff, how are you going to know what you want to write? So you need to have done a lot of work and prepared this in, I don't know, notes, or have it ready in your head or something, and only then you can start writing. So in this phase, when I tried to write my MA thesis, I spent months, literally several months, trying to do this, to follow the advice I was given, or follow this idea, this normative idea of how it's being done. And it didn't get me anywhere because it just didn't work for me. Then after several months of not making any progress, I ditched the advice and I tried to follow the advice of also rather normative writing didactics, which was more like, well, write as soon as possible, but don't worry about producing good text. Just write very rough draft text. Don't bother looking up, for instance, phrases and words. Don't consult dictionaries while you write. Don't try to incorporate sources. You can leave all that for later. Just write rough draft text. And this didn't work for me either. So I spent months trying that out and it didn't work. In the end, I just ditched all the normative advice that I was given and I just figured out what worked for me. And then finally, I was actually able to write the way I needed to for my way of working in this specific situation on this specific kind of text. And listening to normative writing advice had cost me months of work and time, basically. And then I started talking to other people around me, and they had the very, very similar experiences, that they were being given normative writing advice and it didn't help them at all. It kind of hindered them finding out what worked for them.
Our approach aims to enable and empower students to develop a sense of themselves as writers, to be confident in their own strategies of writing. So it's a solutions-oriented approach where we don't have specific ideas about what the solutions should be. In our supervision of student writing, we ask a lot of questions. How are you writing? What works for you? What have you tried? How did you produce the text you're showing me? Was that easy? How long did that take? When did you write? What was difficult about it? What can you change on the level of your individual specific practice to feel better about what you do? How did you overcome writing anxiety? How did you fill the first blank page? And a lot of that practice is part of the book. Of course, in a guide book, we cannot ask these kinds of questions, but we can collect a variety of answers. And that is exactly what we do. We framed writing as a collection of strategies that are part of your individual identity as a writer that you can change, that you can adapt, and you probably will need to adapt it as we did. So from our own writing biography, we knew already that there is no one-fits-all method of writing, but that there is a collection of different things that work for different people. And in the book, we made use of that knowledge and introduced some strategies that have worked well for us historically, that have worked well for our students in our experience, but that in part contradict each other. Not all the strategies that we introduce in the book are compatible. They can't be used all at once, but we encourage students to try them out, to see what works for them, and then to hone their arsenal, which we know from experience they have, and they are well able to develop them.
Also, I think another important point is that we try to find as many points as possible and try to point them out where we can tell the students, look, we think that in this area you already have a lot of expertise, or this is where you should look for the kind of agency that you need in order to become a confident writer. For instance, and this is the cool thing I think about our discipline of Anglo-American literary and cultural studies, as we look at the representations of cultural phenomena and the ideologies underlying these representations, we are all already, every one of you is already an expert in reading the cultural phenomena around us, because we are doing it all the time, right? Whether we are watching an TV commercial or a film, or whether we try to form an opinion about another person based on how they look, their makeup, their hair, their clothing, and so on. We are doing the reading of cultural phenomena around us all the time. So we're already experts on doing this, and we only need the theoretical and scholarly arsenal in order to translate this reading into academic writing. And so we try to point out instances where students already have expertise. Another area is that because our writing is argumentative, we are not like linguistics collecting data, but we make an argument. What we try in our writing is to make a strong argumentative claim about an interpretation of a cultural phenomenon, even though often supervisors will be the experts on the theories used or the methodology used. They can never be more of an expert on the actual argumentative claim than the writer, because the argument someone makes is basically their unique creative contribution that is theirs, that belongs to them. And we try to make a very strong point about this, to encourage students to think about the argument they are making as belonging to them, so that they can feel like they are the experts on this. Pointing out aspects of their writing where they already have expertise, where they are the experts of what they are doing, we felt was an important point in order not to contribute to this feeling that students often have, that they are asked to be experts, because this is what you do when you write academic texts. You are the expert, or you try to inhabit the position of an expert on a specific thing. But if you're a student, you feel like, and you're also being told, that you are not an expert yet. You're a trainee. You're mainly defined by the system, and sometimes also in the way your supervisors treat you, as someone who's not competent yet, who lacks a lot of things. So there's a deficiency-oriented perspective on students that contributes, of course, to this feeling, well, I am not an expert. Everyone, the whole system, tells me constantly I need to be given a lot of rules to follow so that I can write the stuff that I'm supposed to be writing, but I'm not an expert, so how can I find the voice and the position and the confidence to write like one? And this is one of the things that we try to address, at least in the book.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that impressed me most when I was allowed to read like one of the first drafts that you gave me for proofreading. I was really fascinated by the strong position that you take when it comes to encouraging students to turn themselves into experts for their own argument. And I was also very impressed by how you decided to rhetorically address your readers, who are most likely going to be students, but also to include a student writing and student-made examples of academic writing. Can you talk a bit about that?
It belongs to the point that Katharina made, treating students as experts in their own knowledge about culture and literature requires us to tap into the media that they know. So we encourage students to write about topics that they are interested in. And working in literary and cultural studies, this is a great opportunity to tap into their knowledge about popular culture. We supervise papers on contemporary cinema, on superhero movies, for example, or on TV series. I teach classes on zombie culture. I supervise a lot of papers about zombie TV series, for example. We supervise papers on video games, or on YouTube video blogs, or on advertisement. this kind of cultural studies approach is an inherent part of our discipline. But what we usually do in first semester classes is ask students to write essays about a Shakespeare play or about Victorian poetry, something that is completely unfamiliar to their everyday experience of literature, of all kinds of media. I think this is still important. The canonical literature is still something that we should be interested in, that we should teach and so on. But asking students to understand themselves as experts on Shakespeare is kind of ridiculous. But we can ask them to feel like experts on the popular culture they are consuming anyway, and to step out of their role as consumers into a role of an academic, of a scholar, who looks at the media, the phenomena, from a vantage of theory-guided analysis. From all these papers, we have selected examples where we thought our discipline is represented really well. The student had a genuine scholarly interest and conducted themselves as a researcher in our field on something that is not canonical literature, that is not Shakespeare. We also have these things in our examples. It's not that we discourage papers on Shakespeare plays or Victorian poetry. I love reading those. But when we ask students to feel like experts, then it makes it a whole lot easier for them to write about things they know and they are familiar with. And a lot of successful research has come out of that.
Also, our hope with those examples is also to show them that our discipline is not just about highbrow literature, that it seems a bit inaccessible at first, but that all these examples that Till just listed also belong to our discipline and have a proper scholarly place in it, so as to make, I think, as to make what we do more relatable to students.
In your book, you frame academic writing as a communicative act. I really like that you're framing it as a communicative act, because this is what ideally academic research is all about. It's about putting an idea out there and engaging with other researchers in a conversation about a particular topic and about your own arguments. However, there's also the institutional discourse of students writing papers, which is grading, getting credit for something that is being done. And that essentially means that most of the papers that students write in their study program are essentially for an audience of one, maybe an audience of two when we're talking about, you know, the final papers, BA thesis, MA thesis, and so on and so forth. How do you make sense of this discrepancy?
It's I think it's even worse than just being an audience of one, because it's not even the same kind of audience. Usually supervisors are not interested in the work that students do as fellow scholars. They are interested in the work that students do as objects of evaluation. That is very different, because usually supervisors don't read their students in the sense that other members of the discipline's discourse community would read other scholars' contribution, in the sense of, okay, I'm interested in the research, I'm interested in the ideas, I want to learn something from this. Supervisors don't want to learn something from students' research. What they want to see is their proficiency in terms of the writing and in terms of whether they understand how the discipline works. But this is a didactic perspective, even if it's benevolent and all that. So it's not even, I think, an audience of one, but it's a very, very different kind of audience. And I think that this creates actually a contradiction or even a paradox. The situation that student writers are in is very paradoxical, and I think it's really underappreciated in teaching. So on the one hand, students are being asked to adopt the role and voice of an expert, while at the same time, they are being told that they are anything but experts yet. So it makes total sense that students very often when they try to write academic texts, that they feel like imposters because they are asked to occupy a position with authority without having or feeling that they have this authority yet. So how are you supposed to do that? Also, they are being asked to pretend that they are doing meaningful research when the only audience they have, the only reader they actually have, the supervisor, is not interested in their research, in their ideas. They are usually interested in their progression as students. They're interested in treating their research as an object of evaluation. So I think student writing is so tied up in this contradictory position, or even in this paradox, that it makes a lot of sense that there is so much anxiety and fear of failure and worry connected to student writing. And I think it's totally underappreciated by most supervisors that I know of, at least. This is so deeply embedded in the system that there's no easy way around it. But we also say that this is the one of the reasons why our priority or our focus in the book is so much on encouraging students on talking about strategies instead of rules and competencies, and also encouraging students as much as possible as pursuing a sense of self for themselves as writers, so as to enhance their sense of agency. We try to emphasize that they need to find their own writing strategies, because doing that doesn't necessarily solve this paradox. But I think thinking of yourself as someone, as an expert of the argument you're trying to make, but also as an expert of your own writing in the sense of writing processes and writing strategies, is very important in order to getting to a position where you can deal with this contradictory situation that you are in a sense that at least it doesn't really hurt you and damage you.
These paradoxes that Katharina mentioned within the institutional discourse and situation of university are irresolvable, but you can still find your position in it and you can think beyond it. And this is, I think, really important, because knowing how to write well, knowing how to construct an argument is a skill that you will never lose in your life, far beyond the usefulness of knowing how to do that for a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. And this is how we try to frame it in the book, to step out of the bleakness of the paradox as such.
Yeah. I was teaching an advanced academic writing class last semester. I'm going to do so again this semester in spite of the whole COVID-19 situation at the moment. And I totally agree, to help students figure out how they can be experts for their own writing also means acknowledging that students have expertise in their own topics, and to respond to this expertise in a way that is appreciative and acknowledges this. And I don't know whether this is Bielefeld University specific, or whether this is also a practice that we can find in other English departments, in particular in other universities. But I feel like working with a lot of my colleagues writing reports and responses to student papers, I learned a lot about how to be appreciative of this expertise. I've only yesterday finished a report on a BA thesis, and I got to, after handing it in, I talked to my colleague who was the first supervisor, and they said to me that they were in awe of this paper, and talked about in their Gutachten, in their report as well, about how much they had learned through reading this BA thesis about the topic that the student had chosen. And I thought this was a very wonderful way to show to students that they are not talking, or that their audience of one or their audience of two is not this all-knowing entity of some sort that already knows everything that the student is going to write about, but rather somebody they communicate an idea to, and that people can like supervisors, lecturers can genuinely be interested and should be genuinely interested in the arguments that their students put forward. So I really like your approach there. And I think for me, at least, I've learned a lot about the way I do academic writing and I perceive ideas and the way I respond to academic writing through working with you guys and through working with students and talking to them about how their academic writing works and how they would like to receive feedback on their academic writing.
I would like to talk a bit more about the specific strategies that we offer in the book that are explicitly, or that we feel they are the most powerful strategies actually to help students figure out how to write with more agency than this position usually allows them. We've called those things like secret weapons, because I felt that they are not really talked about much. And I can't remember that I have encountered them anywhere so far. But I also feel that they are very, very powerful strategies, actually. And there's also a connection to the first question you asked about writing biographies, because I think maybe the one most important point in my writing biography that led to me being a more confident and also just a much better academic writer was when I read an MA thesis by our colleague Ronja Walter, who wrote her master thesis before I did. And I was so impressed with her text because it sounded so confident and so impressively bold, and she was really sounding like she was the expert on this text and her research and her argument in every single sentence. And this was so impressive because it did not read like a typical student paper where you can still see like the student position that is uncertain of things and doesn't really try to state things boldly and weird theory like a thing that you're really familiar with. But it sounded so much like an expert academic text. And I noticed what she did there. She used the first person a lot. So she said I a lot. She made herself visible as a scholar, and she made the premises she was writing from visible all the time. So she wrote things like, I'm basing my analysis on the premise that this and that, or usually this theory is used in connection to the concept I'm using here, but I'm not going to use the theory because I see these specific problems, especially in the context of my research and so on. And I realized that these strategies, these rhetorical strategies she used there, made her text sound so much more confident and expertly impressive to me. But because it was an MA thesis and not just any regular scholarly text, I thought, well, this is an MA thesis. She's pulling this off, so I can do that too. And then I did in my own MA thesis. And I used all these strategies that she uses, and it helped me so, so much to feel much more confident in what I was doing just because I was using these rhetorical strategies. And it helped me so much to feel like I am the expert on what I am doing, because I was these, when I say rhetorical strategies, and I think we've had this as an objection to the way we write about this from one of our readers. Rhetorics sometimes sounds like it's superficial. It's something you use to kind of disguise that content-wise there are problems. But I don't think about this in this way. I think about having these rhetorical strategies at my disposal actually allows me to state the things that I know, the things that, for instance, the decisions that I made in order to select my theory, to select my methodology, to select the things I wanted to closer analyze in my analysis of my primary text and so on. All these decisions were made, and I think they were informed choices I made. But using rhetorical strategies to actually make these choices explicit and connect them to the theoretical promises that inform these choices made my text so much better.
I totally agree. We can go very, very far back to people who lay the canonical foundation of what we today perceive as argumentative rhetorics, like Cicero, for instance, who makes it very, very obvious that half of the thing is the presentation and that there is great power and agency to be drawn from knowing how to construct an argument rhetorically. And I do think that teaching these rhetorical practices or making students aware of these rhetorical practices, I think is absolutely crucial and a central part of teaching academic writing. It's not just about intellectually how to construct an argument, but it's also about how do I formulate this? How do I create a convincing research narrative? How do I find my own voice? The most well-known researchers, philosophers have very distinctive writing styles. Michel Foucault, Judith Butler, Stuart Hall, all of them write in very idiosyncratic ways that do show that rhetorics matter. And the second thought that I had actually pertains to the discussion of the academic eye, the use of the academic eye. When I was in my master's, I was still struggling with whether or not to use the academic eye. And I was sort of using passive constructions over and over and over again. Very, very weird constructions.
Can I just jump in there? Because I think when you said you used weird passive constructions, I think what you did there, or at least what I did when I was basically in the same position, after I encountered Ronja's text and I realized how liberating I found it to the mere idea to be able to write like this and say I a lot, I realized that what I did when I before I had this realization, I was all constantly looking for ways to hide myself in my own text. So using passive constructions, not using I, using one or something like that, hatching a lot. I think these are all ways of trying to hide myself in my own text, because I was being told, and I think you were too, that this is unscientific.
The point seems to be always when you know, other lecturers, particularly in other fields of study, I don't think this is as prominent in our field of studies as it is in the natural sciences, for instance, is this idea that the academic I, or an I, a personal pronoun, should not be used, or if it is used, it should be used like extremely rarely, because it makes an argument subjective and takes away from the objectivity, which I think is wrong. I wanted to use a different word here, but I think it's wrong. And I do think this is conflating style and representation with the argumentative traction that good pieces of evidence can have. And I do think that using the academic eye, particularly in our field of study, and you've made this very, very clear in the beginning when we started talking about your book, this is, our field of study is about discourse. It is about getting into contact with other researchers to discuss arguments, to discuss points of view, to discuss critically and engage critically with cultural products. And that only works, I think, if we make it obvious that there is positionality to be had.
Yes.
And that works fantastically well with the academic eye. There is a difference between a non-academic use of the personal pronoun and the an academic use of the personal pronoun. And there are texts in which personal pronouns work better than in others. But I do think to just make this blanket statement and say, no, you can't use personal pronouns because they make your text unacademic, or they strip it of objectivity, is ridiculous. I had this very same experience that you had, Katharina. It's very liberating to be given the opportunity to use personal pronouns as a rhetorical strategy to show that one has a position, that I have a position in the field of research, and that I want to engage with other researchers in a communicative act about my position and their position within this research field. I do have a few more questions concerning the book, though. You start off the book with a chapter that you entitled "Instead of a Preface." This "Instead of a Preface" is very personal. It's a conversation between the two of you and Vivian Gramley, the co-author of this book, where you talk about your own writing difficulties, for instance, and write about why academic writing matters to you. What do you think is the benefit that students can derive from reading this specific way of communicating about academic writing?
To me, there is a twofold benefit. On the one hand, it's an immediate introduction into the way we think about academic writing as a personal, individual endeavor that is not immediately comparable to the academic writing that someone else does. This is what we addressed in the first part of the interview, or when we talked about our non-normative approach to introduce strategies of writing that can be adopted by individual writers, regardless of the practice of other individual writers. So in this, instead of a preface, we already introduce some of the strategies that we individually use. So it exemplifies one of the very important premises of the book. The other important function is, I think, to lower barriers immediately. We introduce ourselves as writers with our own difficulties. And in my own teaching of writing, this is an extremely powerful discursive moment in my experience. When I say to my students, I am a binge writer, I know that about myself. I take frantic notes. I'm sort of in an explorative phase in my writing where a lot of ideas are happening. I take notes on that. I write paragraphs, disconnected sentences. I put it on post-its and so on. They lie around for a long time. Anxiety builds because I'm not writing. Then I start drafting here and there. Then I get more text. Then there's a lull in the drafting. Then more anxiety builds. And shortly before the deadline, I get into an intense writing zone and I write pages and pages and pages and pages of almost complete text that has been brewing for a long time. All my notes are coming together. Some are discarded, some are revised, some are made obsolete, some new notes come into play. And then hopefully, and in my experience, usually successfully, the final text emerges from this process. Am I particularly happy about that way of writing? No, because there's a lot of buildup of anxiety. Can I count on that process to work? Yes, so far I can. Am I satisfied with the results? Yes, usually I am. I like what I write. I like how I write. Other people do too. So yes, that's a success, I guess. Just saying that to students, I am a binge writer. You see immediately how they exhale with relief, because they see their own idiosyncratic ways of writing mirrored in what I tell them about how I, as a person, as an academic, write. And I don't go stand in front of them and say, okay, because I am a binge writer, everyone should be a binge writer. Of course, they've learned usually in their writing classes, binge writing is bad. It's not what you do. You should be more systematic. You can't trust the process. You need to build up your text. You need to do that slowly. You do research at one point. You take notes. Then you write draft text. Then you revise the draft text. Then you finalize your text. Then you proofread. This is the kind of normative idea of writing that we try to reject, not because this way it doesn't work or is bad. It's just one way. And some people are able to do that. I admire them. I'm not one of them. I still get shit done. This is, how I try to talk about things, and to do this in a personal way that reduces student anxieties, because they see that their idiosyncratic and weird and sometimes dysfunctional way of writing doesn't make them a non-writer. It just makes them a writer.
I think what this introduction does, albeit very, very briefly, are at least three different important things. For one, you reframe binge writing not as a like a thing that needs to be remedied. You frame it as a strategy. Binge writing is one of the many different writing strategies. And I think this is also one of the things that we talk a lot about in the book. Strategies are strategies. Some strategies for individual writers are more functional than others, but not a single strategy is wrong per se, inherently wrong. And having this idea about writing is about strategies, and some strategies are more functional for a specific writer than others, still leads away from this deficiency-oriented view of I can't write, I am a bad writer or something.
Of course, I had this deficiency view of myself for a long time, right? I thought, oh my God, if this is how I must write, this is extremely stressful, and it goes counter to all the writing instruction I have received. I need to change it. But I wasn't really able to change my way of writing, and I wasn't discontent with the results. So at some point, I said, well, this is the way it works. Why not embrace it?
I said, I think there are three important points to make about the interview. And the first one was to reframe binge writing as a strategy that might be functional or not functional, but it's still just a strategy that people, or that doesn't warrant its being normatively disregarded. So the other two points are, I think, for one thing, we all three of us, Vivian, Till and I, we talked about our different writing strategies. So we exemplified, I think, in the interview, or at least we tried to, that different people use different strategies. Because my writing strategy is very, very different from Till's. And I hinted at that in the interview. But the third important thing is that as authors of this book and as scholars, I think I hope that the interview serves as something that is usually invisible in teaching. Usually students encounter texts either of their instructors and supervisors or of other scholars that they're not personally familiar with in their very finished published form. Everything that leads up to it, all the hard work, all the strategies that these professional academics as writers use, they are completely invisible. And I think having experienced only these finished, published, polished texts also can lead to the idea that this is the kind of text you need to produce when you sit down to start writing. And I think one of the things that we as supervisors and as instructors can do is make our own writing processes visible to our students, make the processes we use that work for us, but also make our own struggles and failures visible to students, to take away this notion that for professionals, these finished texts, they just drop from the sky, basically. And we sit down at one moment having the whole text in our head and just sitting down to write it down. And then it's finished like in the way we see it. That's not the case. But by not doing this, by not including our own writing processes and strategies into our teaching of writing, I think we create this impression, and we should talk way more about our own processes and maybe dare to show our very first, very rough drafts with our students on a regular basis.
Yeah, I feel like there's this myth of certain scholars around who just seem to be sitting down and it's just like coming to them. They just write an article in one sitting. They just, you know, produce the text straight away and it's perfect. And they don't use these strategies. I don't think that's true. Everybody uses writing strategies. And if somebody looks like or perceives themselves as not using any of these strategies, they're simply not aware that they have at one point adopted certain writing strategies that work for them. It just means that not seeing their own writing strategies means that they have picked them up unconsciously at one point. It doesn't mean that they don't have any strategies. And there's also, I think this becomes very, very clear in the way you speak about this and the way you write about this in your book. Writing a lot of text in a short amount of time is not inherently better or worse, or in terms of the arguments that it produces, than writing slowly and methodically. The quality of the argument does not depend on, for the most time, how much time you spend on writing this thing. It depends on how well you know yourself as a writer, as an author of academic text. I for myself, I'm a super slow reader and I'm a very slow writer. I take ages for both things. But that doesn't keep me from producing what I think are valid academic contributions. It just means that I have to plan my writing phases accordingly. And that knowledge alone leads to me being able to produce text just like somebody who is a very, very quick binge writer who sits down for 2 days and writes a whole article in one go. And both are strategies that are fine. One last question, really. In the context of our unconditional teaching project, how do you think this book about academic writing in English linguistics and literature, how does your approach to academic writing that you elaborate on in this book relate to our ideas of unconditional teaching?
So I think it was in my article on how I understand this idea or the concept of the term unconditional teaching. And I wrote something like, unconditional teaching for me very much means accepting that learning belongs to the learner. And for academic writing, I could rephrase a sentence and say, writing belongs to the writer. And writing in the sense, in both senses that we have in English, the process as well as the product. But because the student position is one where students are objects of didactic and sometimes moral and evaluative and so on practices, it's sometimes hard for them to feel that their writing belongs to them. And I think this is one of the most important things that we wanted to do in this book, emphasize explicitly, but also have this as our main approach and premise and perspective on student writing constantly in the things or in the way we talked about writing, to accept that writing belongs to the writers and also to encourage students to think about themselves as writers and as the ones who should be in control of the processes and of the product, and also to take control of their own processes and their own strategies and take control of the argument they want to make. Because of this belief that writing belongs to writers, and that I think I really believe that, especially in our discipline where making a unique creative argument is so important, without someone having this notion that they are the expert on their own writing, that this writing, so the processes as well as the product, belong to them, I think there's no chance they will ever be good, confident academic writers.
Yeah, I have little to add to that. I totally agree. I think another point of intersection, when I think about it now, is that what we write about academic writing, how we treat the process, is informed by an experience that is often denied or unacknowledged in academia. And that is that writing for students is fraught with anxiety and fear of failure in the first place. So this is one of the very immediate and important points of departure for us, that that inform how we approach the writing process in the book. Students rarely lack knowledge or skill or language to write good papers. What they lack is the confidence and the place in the discourse community to feel comfortable contributing their own ideas. So what we address in many of the strategies that we try to convey in the book is these first steps of overcoming the fear of failure and the sense of being lost in a system where I don't belong, that we see many students suffer from. I think this acknowledgement of stress, anxiety, blank page anxiety, fear of failure in students as novice writers is one of the most important points of departures for both the Unconditional Teaching Project and our very concrete writing about writing in the book.
Also, I think it's one of the points where our approach to teaching and writing and also to writing the book and so on differs from the usual writing advice literature that you have. And I would like to mention one example where I think this is becomes very, very, very obvious. One very good strategy to deal with blank page anxiety is to write bad text intentionally. So to encourage someone whose blank page anxiety is really, really bad to kind of circumvent this inner critic that prevents them from putting anything on the page by just writing bad text intentionally, because then this critic can't say, well, this text is really bad because I was doing this intentionally, right? So I still get something on the page. And we wrote a passage about the strategy, just offering this as like a last resort, a strategy that people can use if you have really bad blank page anxiety. But some people were really appalled at the idea that Till and I, encourage students to write badly in this book. This is why the strategy actually is not in the book. And I think this anecdote or this example tells you something about the hegemonic way of thinking about writing, and that the mere idea that we encourage students to write bad texts intentionally, even if it serves a very specific purpose, and even if you make it very explicit that this is draft text, this is not finished text, right, goes still so much against conventional wisdom and goes so much against the ideas that we usually have about how to teach writing.
I'm almost on the verge of bursting into laughter, because when I remember I don't have blank text, blank page anxiety as much as others do, but of course I struggle with producing text as well. So a lot of the times my first draft, like the very, very rough drafts, will sound extremely colloquial and will have a lot of expletives in them, because it's essentially my own thought process when I encounter cultural products for the very first time or theory for the very first time is, what the F is this? I don't get this. Research! Exclamation mark. And like, I put together like very rough draft texts in this very colloquial style, but this is not for publication. I'm aware that this is not the final outcome, but I need to produce this rough, expletive-filled, very, very colloquial text in order to get my ideas and my questions onto the paper. And I can think about how to make it academic, how to polish it rhetorically later in a separate step. So I actually find this quite valuable to not do this. One of our colleagues, Pat Skorge, taught me very, very early on to not write well, but to write now. And I find this is such a good practice to do, to separate the thinking and putting ideas onto the page step from the step of polishing the rhetorics. Yeah, I'm actually sad that this is not in the book.
I have a question for you, because before we started recording the interview, you said that, or you hinted at the things that you think make the book different from your point of view, from others that are about similar topic. And I would be interested actually what your thoughts are, because I would like to know what other people who are not us, so who haven't gone through thinking about it as much, see it when it's almost finished now. And yeah, what do you think of it? And especially what do you think makes it work or makes it different?
Yeah, I can. I feel when I read this, I mean, I know a lot of very solid, sometimes even very good guidebooks on academic writing. But I think your book, it doesn't read so much like a guide. It reads like a conversation throughout. It reads like a collection of ideas. It doesn't read like a roadmap to me, like this is how you can do it. It reads like a collection of suggestions. And it reads like it is a conversation between you guys and me, the reader, that is happening on eye level. And that is what I personally really, really enjoy about any type of academic text. If I were to compare this, or if I had to compare this to any other academic text that I know in terms of style, I would most compare to Stuart Hall's The Work of Representation, because there he does a very, very similar thing. He basically incorporates the readers by the use of personal pronouns. He makes this, he turns this into a community exploration of a topic. And I think this is something that you are doing too in this book. It is a communal experience of exploring different practices of academic writing. For me, that leads to the feeling of not being instructed, but rather being given the freedom to explore how I can work in academic writing. And I wouldn't be surprised to hear that this may be an experience that students of academic writing or students in our department share with me once they get their hands on this book.
Wow, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear it, because I mean, this was exactly what we were aiming for, but you never know how other people actually perceive it and read it.
Yeah.
And it's not only sort of when you say that's what we were aiming for, it's not how we contrived this, but yeah, it's a representation of our experience of how we got there, how we know what we know. To me, everything I know about teaching writing, I know from students. I know from asking students about how they write. I don't know it from other guidebooks. I don't know it from my teachers. I know it sometimes from my own experience with writing and how that has developed over the years. But mostly I know it from conversations with my students. And if that is then represented in the book, and from what you said, I feel that is represented in the book, that you read it in the book, I'm absolutely happy.
Yeah, thanks so much for writing this. I can't wait to use it in my own academic writing classes, actually.
Writing in English Studies, A Guide for Students in English Linguistics and Literature, written by Vivian Gramley, Katharina Peach and Tils Bura, is out now. You can get your hands on it by checking out the publishing house's website or Verlag Barbara Budrich, that is budrich.de, or of course by visiting your local bookshop. Thanks for listening. Unconditional Teaching is a project by Katharina Peach, Tilsi Bura, and myself, Jessica Koch. Music by Lily Olason. If you want to know more about our project, head over to unconditional-teaching.com. Do you like our content and would like to engage with us? Check out our comment sections or contact us via team@unconditional-teaching.com.